Our presenter this morning, James O'Hara, is a former math instructor, massage instructor, and a dream worker who studied and worked with the late Jeremy Taylor. He was also a brother in a Catholic religious order for nearly 30 years. And after serving in India and Nepal for 7 years, he came to question his vows and his deepest beliefs, and he left the brotherhood and the church. He authored a book about these experiences and his life transformation called In the Land of Shiva, which we have four books over here of his In the Land of Shiva, and he does have more in the car if they sell out. So, and he a few years ago he presented a wonderful slideshow and talk here on that on his book and his experiences. And last year he did a tribute to his mentor and friend Jeremy Taylor on the multiple meaning of dreams. And he's currently working on his next book. And he says he has it 80 to 90% done, so we can look forward to another one soon. And his presentation this morning will be on the subject of that book, which is Accidental Soul Work. So let's give a warm welcome to James O'Hara.
Thank you, Barbara. So, yes, it's good to be back here, and a number of familiar faces I've been walking around saying hello again, because I don't remember all the names, and I hope you will indulge me in that. One quick word about that book. It's entitled In the Land of Shiva. And in Hinduism, Shiva is also called the destroyer. Now, the thing is, Shiva destroys only that which is no longer needed. Prunes away that which is no longer needed. Because when I first heard that one of their gods was called a destroyer, I thought, well, how negative. But it is the same concept of the seed falls into the ground, dies, and something comes forth. And so what I did not need anymore at that point in my life, and others may need this, I do not, and it's okay. We're all on different paths. I did not need a structured religion, so I left that behind. So, when I did that, the most common question was, well, what are you going to do now, now that you're not a brother? That wasn't the most common question. And by the way, as Barbara mentioned, I had been a math instructor for many number of years, and I loved it. I actually did. I taught sixth graders. Oh, they were so exciting. And freshmen, well, all of high school, college. So anyway, what am I going to do? No, they didn't ask that. The question mainly was, what? You left your church? Well, what have you replaced it with? Oh. In other words, and I understand that. I ask myself the same question. And then we often, we appreciate the support of a community. Any kind of community, and the community that comes together might be like-minded souls, whether you meet every Friday as Muslims, Saturday, Jews, Sunday, traditionally as Christians. There is support in that, and there's also ritual. So, what have I replaced that with? And the... Oh, I thought I smelled oil, right? I didn't know if the devil was after me. Okay. So what have I replaced it with? Somewhat nothing. And the challenge for me has been to do soul work without that framework. Now, the topic for today, accidental soul work. What in the world does that actually mean? Well, I think we all understand the word accidental. Now, what is soul work? One of the things I'm not going to do is begin with a definition, because I suspect that that phrase, soul work, if there are 25 people in this room, there are probably 25 different angles on that, and that's beautiful. Each one of us has his or her own approach to what is spiritual work. I will give you, after I read a few stories, I will give you my version, and I will be interested in hearing yours as well. But I'm still even hesitant about my own definition, because words, try as we might, and I think we have to try to explain these things, they just don't always manage it. The 13th century poet Rumi said, language is like a tailor's shop in which nothing fits. We try to explain things, and wars and torture have ensued over people not agreeing on certain definitions of things. So I think the Buddha, who lived about 2,500 years ago, had a lesson for us in that. So let me tell you this little story. It wasn't a wild Saturday night. I'm just thirsty. So in northern India, in the state of what is now Bihar, although they keep changing the names over there every year, could be a different name of the state. But anyway, in the northern area of India, there's a city called Rajgir. And there is in that town a rather tall hill or small mountain, however you wish to call it. And during the hot weather, the Buddha used to gather his disciples there and give them the talks. Because later on, when the weather got cooler after the monsoons, then they would go out and preach in the villages and so forth. So I actually happened to be there several years ago, and I wanted to find a place called Vulture's Peak. Because Vulture's Peak, I see some know this, Vulture's Peak is the place where the Buddha gave possibly his most famous sermon, the Flower Sermon. Anybody ever hear the Flower Sermon? Okay, great. All right, see if my version is anything like what you've heard. So I go there, and there's a chairlift taking you way up to the top. I went up there. And I'm looking at the guidebook. It said, yeah, Vulture's Peak is here. But there were no signs in Hindi or English. And because I could read a little bit of Hindi still at the time. So finally, I started asking guides. They didn't know. So here's a little hint for you in your travels. If you're stuck and can't find what you want, you look up. You go for those little scrappy 10-year-old kids who sell trinkets and postcards. They will know. Their little projects depend upon knowing the names that tourists use. So I asked, and they explained, and it's that way, and gave them the rupees, and then, of course, went there and found it. It was deserted. Other parts of that hill were populated, but perhaps the most famous part was completely deserted. It was labeled as the place the Buddha gave the flower sermon. So here's the story. One day when he gets there and his disciples are gathered for the usual talk, and it went on usually for a while, because if you walk someplace for an hour, you don't want a 10-minute little sermon. Okay, so usually they were rather long speeches, teachings. And that day, everybody has gathered, and he walks out, and he has a flower in his hand. And he just does this. This goes on for quite a while. I won't do that. And then the disciples start guessing. Flower, it's the law of impermanence. Flower, he's trying to tell us this, that, or the other thing. Or he's trying to say, what's the meaning of life? What's the meaning of a rose? All these theories were coming forth, and then he still said nothing. And finally, this one disciple started smiling and then laughing. And the Buddha said, "What can be put into words, I have already told everyone. What cannot be put into words, this person understands." That disciple's name was Mahakasyapa, and he turned out to be the person who followed in the Buddha's footsteps as leader of the tribe. So this is why I'm a little bit wary of definitions. You may recall, as Barbara mentioned, that I was in the Catholic Church. If there's any group that's good at definitions, I'm telling you, they can define infallibility, immaculate conception, definitions all over the place. So I'm wary of that right now. So I'm going to tell you a few stories. The first one is about, it's entitled, "My Hands Have Memory." And it has to do with this. When I returned from India and Nepal and wanted to move on, the question I had for myself is, what will I do now? And even though I enjoyed teaching math, I didn't want to do that again. So a friend said, in the Bay Area here, he said, "You know what? You've been tromping around India, Nepal, night trains, overland buses. You're probably needing to spend time on your own physical well-being. I heard there is this massage program for a couple of weeks." And I thought, well, that'll be cool. I'm going to be taking dream work from Jeremy Taylor. I'm going to be doing this. And, oh, a couple of weeks massage. That'll be cool. That'll kind of add a little different flavor. That offhand comment, I took those classes, took more, and it evolved into a wonderful, satisfying career of over 25 years. So accidental. So, you know, he just said it. Had I thought of massage myself as a massage therapist? I was a mathematician. But I went from the cerebral to the sensate. From math to massage, and I found it a wonderful balancing act. But what did I learn in terms of soul work from that? Well, indulge me if you will, I'm going to read. "A small book would be required to relate all I learned by participating in massage, so I shall only mention two items. Firstly, I gradually was able to withdraw my judgments of another person based on the condition and status of their body. Yes, I periodically did think to myself, he's quite overweight, and that's not healthy. He should do something about it. Why hasn't he? If she would pay more attention to nutrition and exercise, she wouldn't complain about constant lack of energy. Doesn't she have any self-discipline?" Of course, all these are projections on my part. Me, self-deficient, me, okay. "Little by little, however, as I came to know these individuals and heard some of their stories, I took stock of my attitude. I stepped back from such constant judgment and most surprisingly and most importantly, somehow reached the point where I didn't need to know someone's backstory to have compassion for them. Compassion doesn't require understanding. Compassion doesn't require understanding. It is simply an attitude and habit of the mind and heart we first extend to ourselves and then to others. Secondly," I hope I can get through this. "Secondly, I learned at a depth that I had never understood before to be truly present to the person in front of me. While I like to think I developed that attitude with each and every client, no clients were more my teachers in that matter than those who were sick or dying. One day, a soft-spoken, youngish-sounding man hesitantly spoke on the phone. Do you massage people with AIDS? It broke my heart that he felt he had to ask, but I suppose he had received rejections in various ways already. We booked in an appointment, and I gave him my address. Chris saw me for several sessions. An artist and sensitive soul, this beautiful young man with a once nearly perfect body said little as we worked together. His sad eyes spoke more than his words. He lay on my massage table, his body racked by an invader, and seemed to have complete trust in me and my touch. I have seldom been in the presence of someone I had so wanted to hold and will his disease away. That did not, could not happen. But I was forced to be totally present as my hands massaged his fragile body. I could not let myself think of my shopping list or anything else so trivial in comparison with that man's life. I would gauge his response to my touch not only by verbal comments he gave, but also by the slight reactions of his body. He might retract ever so slightly from my touch, which I interpreted as my pressure being too much, or that he was finished with massage for the day. He could absorb only so much. I knew that people with life-threatening conditions were often subject to abrupt, invasive procedures, and light massage was a time of physical nurturing and sometimes healing for the spirit, if not the body. When Chris could no longer physically come to me or afford payment, I went to the hospice where he was then staying to give him massage. Each week, I could feel the continued wasting of his body, and one day he was gone. It seems that my hands have memory. And while that can be useful to assess positive development of muscle tissue, it also means I'm brought directly into contact with the dying process. Only by bringing focus to my work, being centered, totally present, and calling upon all spiritual guides could I continue that ministration. So what had started as an offhand comment by someone, well, maybe you'd want to take a couple weeks of massage, turned out to be this amazing experience and pushed me. I'm telling you, I never understood what it really meant to be present to someone until I did massage on people who were dying. And it was a nonverbal experience. That's the other part. The powerful part of it was nonverbal. Okay, I'm going to, in a moment, read another story for you, but I just want to take a moment in case anybody has something they want to say or ask about that story or about what I've said so far. We can take comments along the way, if you wish. All right, over here. Now, this is going to... Yes, it is.
Thank you. My question is this. How do you care for yourself when you are doing work like this?
Boy, that is a key question. I think that's true in any work that we do. And I have learned this for myself. I have to schedule it. I cannot depend upon... I'm a double Virgo, and I don't know if you know anything about Virgos, but we bring out that calendar and get life organized. And I mean, I went to India to organize India. I mean, how hard could it be? So, yes, that's what I had to do. I had to put downtime in my schedule. If not, it would fill up because I was also teaching at California's largest massage school at the time. And so between private clients and the teaching, I had to actually schedule it. And guess what? It's like the cobbler's kids run barefoot. How many times have I had to make a decision to get massage for myself? Okay, anything else before we go on?
As
a person who had a lot of background with the Catholic Church, where they undoubtedly thought that they had something to say about this process of dying, I was wondering if, when you had transitioned to being a massage therapist, that you in fact drew on something deep that did relate to the faith or your practice with the Catholic Church.
Well, there's a good question too. So, definitely. Can I exactly say what it was? I don't know. Because here's what someone said to me, another form of your question. It's like, well, now that you're no longer a brother, a Catholic, not even a Christian, do you regret all that time? And my response was, absolutely not. First of all, no situation is perfect. So we know that. But what I said was, and I still say this, I am pleased with who I am today, with all my rough edges. I'm still pleased with who I am today. And I know that who I am is the result of everything that's come before. Everything. And perhaps more specifically, in terms of my experience with the Catholic Church, that sense that there's more here than meets the eye. And one of the things you get in community situations is the opportunity for ritual. And what ritual is, in my opinion, it basically is something we do that tells us there's more going on here than meets the eye. And I certainly got that. And I think that sustained me. All right. Oh, I've turned it off. It's off.
You're hitting the other line.
Hmm? Oh, I'm hitting this. Oh, thank you. Oh, I need practical help. Now, the reason I like telling stories is to give you the example of what I come to later on, because I have a friend who's looking at my book and he's saying, well, why don't you state that here and then give some examples? But for me, life doesn't work that way. Here are the stories. Here's what I learned. And so, in fact, I love this quote from Tobias Wolff, American author. Something like this. A person's real life is nothing but the sum total of the small stories experienced over years and years, given meaning and integration through soulful reflection. And we each have stories in here, every one of us. Okay, let me go on to the second thing, the second story. And meanwhile, again, after the story, I'm going to ask you if you have any thoughts for what soul work might mean for you, or if you have any examples of some accidental, seemingly accidental event in your life which led you to some deeper place. All right, I'm going to read little patches of this. I believe almost all of us do our work accidentally, in the sense, our soul work, in the sense that we are not necessarily conscious that that's what we're doing when we start it. Who among us has said something like, I believe I'll go into real estate, medicine, teaching, or start a family to do my soul work? Well, we probably didn't even, when we were deciding those things in our 20s, we may not have even been thinking about something called soul work. We wanted to do something we thought we would enjoy or bring us a nice living, or perhaps even follow in the footsteps of somebody in our family. As we learn our craft, we may begin to see the challenges in our work as vehicles for self-reflection and personal growth, not just outward obstacles to be overcome. When that happens, we are on the threshold of doing soul work. This can happen in any profession, any family situation, with any physical illness or disability that may come our way. And even if fate
somehow lands us in a profession not originally of our choice, that vehicle can do its work on us also. I never really planned to be a teacher. And teaching has been a joy in my life, and engaging with people has pushed me to see other points of view, to open up, to have compassion. So I never, ever thought I would be a teacher. How did that happen? In high school, we had a career day each year, and representatives of various professions gave short talks about their work. We could choose which presentations we wanted to attend. And although as students we were surrounded by teachers on a daily basis, there was always a talk given by a teacher from another school. I never attended the teacher talks. I chose journalism once. How exciting to be covering major disasters or helping to solve crimes with my astute investigative reporting. Another time I went to listen to a member of the U.S. Navy. I had heard that at the end of basic training, you went on a round-the-world cruise. Now that was cool. Images of swabbing decks never entered my mind. I was a teenager. That all-boys school, so basically, I was at that school that the brothers taught. And when I looked at these men, I would say the biggest thing that I got was these were not only good men, but they projected having purpose in their life. I cannot say I was in love with God or I did this for the love of God or something. I just saw people who had purpose. And I said, I want to be like that. And I think there's some places it's called exemplary causality. In other words, one of the biggest causes for motivation for us can be someone else who embodies what we would like to become. And once I decided I wanted to be like them. It only dawned on me later that I would therefore have to become a teacher because that's what the brothers do. In fact, it was a minor shock that I now had a profession cut out for me. No more waffling concerning which career path to follow. Now, also then the question, what am I going to teach? And again, I was young. I said, I'm going to teach what was taught by the teachers I liked the best. And that happened to be mathematics. And again, where did that come from? I suspect it comes from somewhere deep that we don't even know. And I threw myself into it. I delighted in taking the nervous freshman who claimed he'd been traumatized by fractions in the fifth grade and would never be able to do algebra, taking him or her to small and then larger successes in the field of math, and along with that, to an increase in self-confidence and self-esteem. No matter if the person never used algebra again in his life, they had overcome an obstacle and felt good about themselves. And by the way, again, I can say this as a former math instructor. One of the favorite cartoons I saw once on Facebook was this person going, oh, another day that I didn't use algebra. I totally relate. Let's see where we are. All right. Before I say what I think soul work is, because I don't want to push anybody in a certain direction or influence you, rather, I'm interested in seeing if there are any comments, either about the story, questions, or... So four things. Comments, questions about the story. What you think soul work is, and or can you think of an example in your life where something that just, you look back and you went, well, how did that happen? But meanwhile, it was so meaningful to me. Anybody want to throw something out on that? And you don't have to.
I'd like to comment on the first thing, first question you asked, which was, what did I think soul work was? And I was trying to remember, I think it was in my studies of Hinduism. There's many paths to worship, and one of them is devotional, and another is through intellect, maybe the Jesuits, another maybe more Franciscan. And I was wondering if maybe some of the soul work, the last thing you mentioned, was more devotional. Some of us, with shock, find that underneath our cynicism, we have a very devotional nature. It makes sense when Rumi says, God is the beloved.
Thank you. And thank you for reminding us about those four paths, sometimes called the four yogas. One is knowledge. One is devotion, such as the Hare Krishnas, in a sense. One is service. And one is meditation. So people, it's a paradigm, which I like. It helps us get going. And do you have one of those that you relate to the most?
I'm kind of mystical.
Mystical, okay. That's called the royal path. It is. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I guess it's a comment relating to the accidental in the title and a life, a sense of a life filled with accidents. The notion of luck, a lady luck in our lives, and the notion of the good or bad fortune in the accidents of life. It was a major theme of philosophy millennia or so ago. So it's the sense of, and so that's that thought. And then you mentioned at a point in your career where you had a sense of a life of purpose versus you were waffling was the word that you used. And the notion of Robert Frost's poem about couldn't decide which path to take, that waffling, two roads appeared in a yellow wood. The sense of a life where your life is sort of laid out in front of you and you're following that life versus a life that's full of accidents of one sort or another, and a soul, your soul or our soul, that's dealing with that life of accidents.
Great, thank you. And as I walk over here, I'm going to mention that Eric Erickson talks about eight stages of spiritual development, psychosocial. And the eighth one is old age, and it is 65 and older. For those of us who fall in that category, here's what he says. That in each phase, each stage, there's a dynamic that we switch between. And in that stage, the dynamic is switching between despair or integration. And I love this statement. Something you said triggered this in me. He said, if we, at that stage in our lives, feel that we have lived a meaningful life, then we will lean toward integration. If we sadly feel we haven't done anything and we've been not good at this or relationships or whatever, we may move toward despair. And that would be sad. So if in our older years, one of the things that it behooves us to do is to think of what our life has, how it has been meaningful and how it can continue to be so.
It was sort of an accident that I went to a Jeremy Taylor dream workshop. Jeremy used to be a good friend of my sweetheart, and I just went along. But I was fascinated by the simplicity and the power of the dream work. If people keep a dream diary, they write down their dreams as quickly as they can after they wake up, and then they speak of their dreams at the workshop, and everyone gets to say, if it was my dream, and interpret the dream. Well, I went to the workshop. It was held here twice, in several years apart. And I noticed something. I noticed that a lot of people turned up at the first session. Only a few people turned out at the second session. And after the sessions were over, I tried to get a dream workshop going using the same format that Jeremy Taylor had used, and I found that I was the only one who was still keeping a dream diary. Now, I really don't understand that, because to me the dream diary thing is fascinating. Why would anyone quit?
Aren't you a writer?
I am a writer.
Well, there's the clue. Not everybody really wants to write and or have that particular discipline. And again, there are many paths up the mountain, and I, for one, love the path of dream work. And not everybody is into writing or journaling about their life in general. There are workshops on journaling. Years ago, I went to one called Progoff Method. Anybody ever hear of that? Yeah. Yeah. And it was valuable. Even though I write, I didn't keep that up. But I think that's the thing. It's different strokes for different folks is my hit.
Well, I'm not sure if this is accidental exactly, or if it's an example of this, but a couple times in my life I've experienced a depression, and it's led me to therapy. And you know, I've grown a lot as a result of that therapy, and actually I'm here at this church as a result of the therapy in the last time, because I realized there was sort of something missing in my soul. And it's kind of like, you know, I didn't intend to experience a depression, but it led me to something that, you know, it was like telling me something.
Well, agreed. That is, the word accidental can be an umbrella word for many things, things that we simply did not choose. And in retrospect, would not have chosen it. But now we did see the benefit of that.
I'm afraid I'm a ringer, having been in dream groups with Mr. O'Hara and benefited most well. Thank you for your carrying on Jeremy's work. For me, actually, something happened at age 18 that is really, I really remember my whole life. I had been made a cheerleader, the first black cheerleader at Abington High School. And at the end of each game, there was an old man who called the games and everything, you know, Mr. Henley, let's just call him. And at the end of each game, you know, my little airhead 18-year-old, you know, age would just say, and thanks to Mr. Henley for the, you know, for calling the game, and then you run off and get hamburgers with the other kids. And when this guy retired, and he was, I mean, if I was 18, he was at least 55. No, but I think he was much older. And he came up to me and he said, in all the years I've been here, no one ever, ever thanked me after each game like you did. And that's all he said to me. And from that moment on, it was more than accidental. It wasn't even a thought. From that moment on, every interaction, I always know, I never know how it's going to be. And so the beloved's face is on everybody.
That's beautiful. We do not know the consequences of our action. But what I get from that also is, what's the word I want? Stick-to-itiveness. You learn something and then kept doing it. And that's huge. Okay, I'm going to give you my little, first of all, the short version.
But I have to organize my notes a minute here.
All right. So the short version is... The short version is, okay, what is soul work? Soul work is any activity that helps us transcend the physical self and personal ego. Any activity that helps us transcend the physical self and personal ego. In other words, we are more than this, and especially if we are not feeling well, it behooves us to remember that we are more than this body. So anything that transcends the physical self, and we don't have to wait until we're sick for that. We could do it before then. Dream work is one of the ways. I'm going to say something in a moment about astrology. Okay, and transcending the personal ego. Ego is defined basically as separateness. And most religions that I have studied have some version of saying, you are part of the group. You're part of the great entity. In Hinduism, you're an Atma, you have soul, but eventually you're part of Brahma, the big story. Okay. In Christianity, some, I know in Catholicism, it was soul and then mystical body of Christ. There was always something bigger that says we are more than our physical self, we are more than our ego. But what are we, therefore, a part of? Well, again, Rumi saying, language is a tailor's shop in which nothing fits. What would I describe that great entity as? And, you know, religion will want to describe what God is like, what God thinks, what attributes God has, and so on. That's, to me, a dangerous path to go down. So I can only give an analogy. And here is the analogy that I have come to. Each one of us is a thread in the great fabric. Now remember, a metaphor is going to have things that works, things that don't work. But I love that. We are all threads in the great fabric, because as soon as we try to describe what that fabric is, we are going to fall short. Nothing will fit with that language. Now, there have been hints along the way that, lost my train of thought there. There have been hints along the way about that fabric. One at the microcosmic level is traditional Chinese medicine. How many in here have heard of those energy lines called meridians on the body? Probably a number. You're right. Okay. Now, what I find interesting about that is the word meridian comes to us in English from a French translation of those early texts. And meridian, of course, you know, there's that line painted on the imaginary line painted on the globe or whatever it is. But the word, I am told, in the original text is way closer to the word thread. Those energy lines are like threads of a knit shirt. You cannot separate the shirt from the threads. And if it's truly a knit shirt, as opposed to a woven fabric shirt, if it's truly a knit shirt, you could start pulling on that one thread, and then what are you going to have? A pile of thread and no shirt. You cannot separate the thread from the fabric. All you can do is see what form it's in at this moment. And that helps me understand a lot of things that we call synchronicity. A few years ago, I was in Hanoi, Vietnam, and
it was part of, you may recall, French Indochina. So there's a lot of French, old French-style buildings there. And I'm walking back one day from having gone to the Hanoi Hilton. Remember the Hanoi Hilton where the prisoners of war were kept? Yeah. And I was walking back, and I stopped to look at this old French building, and it had a garden in front. I walked in, and I thought, well, it doesn't have any sign. I wonder what this is. I hear an American voice behind me. I turn around, and so I asked this guy, do you know what this is? No, but, and we chat. He is from my hometown of Milwaukee. He had gone to grade school at the church where I had been baptized. Okay, and it's like, here we are in Hanoi. And it's like, how does this stuff work? And I think when we're all threads, a continuing thread in this great fabric, it's not surprising that we see part of our own history when we come around again because of that connection. Okay. Now, I think I have time for, I'm going to say something about astrology, maybe something more about dreams. Now, anybody here who has never seen an astrology chart? Oh, good. You're the one I want. So you're going to look first at my chart. Now, don't worry about all these little squiggly lines and circles and odd, really weird little symbols. Just take a look at the visual. And is there anything you notice just visually about that chart?
I notice that it's a combination of numbers and symbols. I notice that there are some sexual symbols.
I noticed
the women especially.
Venus. Venus is the female sign. Mars is the male sign. Yes.
Okay. And a lot of attempts to connect.
Okay.
In the center.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Anybody else want to look at and just see if you see, notice anything at all?
Sure.
Is he an astrologer?
No, the wife not.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, a clock. All right. Barbara wants to. These are all absolutely correct.
Yeah, it tends to be concentrated in a small area.
Okay, I don't know if you can. First of all those lines are connecting lines of energies. And if you see this, you will notice that a lot of those symbols are in one little section, right? I don't know if you can see that right here. Okay, see right under my finger there? All those things, all that energy going on in one section. Now, what that means in astrology is that theoretically, I should have a lot of energy in whatever themes belong to that area. Now, by the way, you can see that there's moon in there, right? The crescent. And this is sun. So the two most important planets in astrology are sun and moon. And I have them in that all in, collected in that one section. It means a certain area of the sky. I was born at 1:30. So the sun was, you know, just past the noon point. But there were also other planets out there you could not see because of the sun. Now that section of the sky, called the ninth house, that section of the sky has themes to go with it. Barbara, would you read the themes for the ninth house?
Collective mind, broader viewpoints, travel, religion,
philosophy, and mental studies.
The story of my life. What is not on here is publishing, foreign cultures, but that's the travel part. And I did not see my chart until I was in my 50s. If I had seen it earlier, someone might have said, well, you're just, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, as I like to say, I don't believe in astrology. However, because I don't believe in anybody coming along and saying, this is what unseen realities are. I've done that. Been there, done that. I drank the Catholic Kool-Aid. Won't be doing that again. So, but does it help me in any way? Does it describe something for me? And for people like myself who are not enlightened, it's nice to have confirmation. And the confirmation is that I've been doing those things, and the theory of astrology is I would be doing my soul work if I'm doing those things. I've done every one of those. The one that also is not on there that I haven't done but I'm very interested in is law. I'm very interested in law, and I'll give you one quick example. Do you have a question?
Yes. In your poignant discussion of your body work, particularly with the dying, with the AIDS patient, I felt a visceral reaction related to the compassion, the sense of the depth of feeling and emotion that connects us all, whatever that is. How does that fit in this particular picture? Because I didn't hear that come up where the compassion comes from, and the fact that you discovered it emerged in you had the emergent experience of something you could then label as compassion, but I don't necessarily think of that as sort of that ninth house sector focus.
So how does massage and everything?
That's the biggest soul work in my understanding of you.
It's certainly a major one, and what. Again, I don't want to get into too great a depth of astrology and leave anybody behind, but I happen to be a Virgo, and I have Sun and Moon, the two most important planets in Virgo. The body part for Virgo, by the way, is in the intestines. And lo and behold, I'm gluten intolerant. Who knew? Okay. But also the hand. The hand and physicality is part of that. The Virgo three themes are service, a brother for 30 years, and still, without being a brother, doing massage is a service. Service, health. I got interested in the health field. And thirdly, daily work that's significant to me. If I would not be, and I know people who love numbers in not a different way than I do, but love accounting. I don't. So I wouldn't be able to do accounting every day, even for the big bucks. Because with all that Virgo energy, it's like, I need meaningful work every day. So that's how I relate that, including the massage and the hands. Okay, one quick example about law is this was years ago. Some author, I don't know, from the 30s or 40s, a well-known author, I don't remember his name right now, had a mistress to whom he sent many, many lurid letters. Okay. So the guy passes on, and he's very famous. And the woman says, well, I could use a few bucks. Why don't I take these letters, put them into a book, and publish it? These are mine. And the estate said, no, you can't do that. It goes to court. Anybody want to guess what the outcome was? How would you know? Just guess. Okay. The court said this, and this is the part about law I like, the distinctions. They said, look, you got those letters. You're the mistress. Okay. You got the letters. They belong to you. Anything you get in the mail that you didn't request belongs to you. You can take those to Sotheby's and auction them off. You cannot take the words of the author, which belong to his estate, and put them in a book. Interesting distinction. All right. Let me see. What else do I want to get to before we Oh, this might apply to this group particularly. Okay, going back to your Latin 101. Who remembers, I had to look this up myself, what the phrase cuius regio eius religio? What?
Something about kings and religion.
Yes.
Okay, in English, all right, I'm going to give you a Greek next time. Cuius regio eius religio? Whose realm, his religion? Okay. And in days of old, you know, the religion of the people had to become the religion of the conqueror. Now, I translate that to one of the things that perhaps in this country a lot of us have done somewhat unthinkingly, which is the king and queen of our home, our family of origin, probably gave us what their religion was. And many of us followed it. Now, I say with this group, I suspect that's not the truth for a lot of you. How many people here had parents in a UU church? Okay, great. The vast majority of you have taken your own path and looked what is meaningful for me today in my life. What can I relate to? And I applaud you for that. All right. So, said something about astrology. Didn't say much about dreams. I'm talking about the helps towards soul work. One quick dream I had a few years ago. And in the dream, the dream is titled, Losing My Wallet. And that's all there is to that dream. I couldn't remember anything except that was what the dream was. I lost my wallet. I was so upset. I jumped out of bed, went over to my suitcase, and of course in the outer world, everything was just hunky-dory. I had my license, my passport, everything. Has anybody in here ever had a dream about losing their wallet or something like that? Okay, it happens. Cutting to the chase here. One hit on that, and I say one because there are no doubt many, is that at that time in our lives, perhaps we are letting go of some identity or some role that we have had. Our wallet contains usually our driver's license, which in this country is getting even more and more to be like a national identity card. How many of you got your real ID? Okay, good. And it has to do, it certainly did for me. And what it was another wake-up call. I am not my roles. That comes upon many people if they are parents when their children move out, spouses when one of them passes on. I am not a parent anymore. I am not a spouse. I am not, or if I am a parent still, those kids are grown. They're doing their own things. They never listen to me anymore. So our roles cannot be it. Now, if we are not our roles, then who are we? The ancients had the answer to this. It has been sitting there licking its chops, waiting to see when the question is raw enough to actually hear the answer. And what they say, I'm going to explain a little bit, and then we're going to stop because I think, well, this is the time for questions. We're going to do that. Move from roles to soul. Nice and simple, but what does it mean? Okay. The best hit on that is Moving from roles to soul says that we understand we are not the roles and we give up our identification with roles. Someone asks me who I am, I'm going to say, I'm a writer, massage therapist. We all do it. Fine. But moving from roles to soul says letting go of identification with a role, because that will disintegrate. It will at some point in time, just like our bodies, turn to ashes. Now, it doesn't mean we shouldn't have roles in our later years. Because especially in our later years, hopefully, we have something to offer. And taking on roles of mentor, whatever it is, teacher, is a boon to others. So it is not putting down roles, it's just saying a personal piece of soul work would be, see if we can step back from the identification with that role. Okay, I got 2 more hours, but let's take, Barbara said at 10:30 questions, and let's see anybody who hasn't had a question yet, or comment, either way.
The term soul work by itself might be problematic because I think in order to arrive at some kind of enlightenment, we have to be at rest from our own work. And so if that's the case, then why not just be at rest and forget about all the work?
He's my man. Forget about the work. All right. So, yeah, and maybe let me rethink that. Maybe it's just soul consciousness instead of soul work. But your point is well made. Let's see how else we can get to this by grunting and groaning, because that doesn't usually work.
Synchronistic. I keep coming back to the image in my mind of you working with this person who is dying and what's emerging in you as you're doing this work. And I'll add to that, my experience in what I'll call soul work has to do with recognizing that I don't know where I'm going. I'm actually heading into new territory. If I knew what soul work was and something I could just do, I would just do it. But it's a new state for me. It's a new being that's emerging. So when that sort of thing happens, it's not so much something I do with my ego or with my will. I make myself available when choices occur to take the road less traveled. And in that, something is revealed to me, but it's not something I do. And so I'm discovering myself. And so all that background inside me, that non-conscious stuff, gets an opportunity to present itself and to speak. And it's not murmurs anymore. You kind of give it the microphone for a while. And you let it say something that we haven't heard of, or maybe it's bigger than that collection of parts that we are. But it's always, in my experience, not intentional, except for the being available and being willing to choose the unfamiliar and maybe uncomfortable path. And in that experience, I'm discovering the larger me.
I want that recorded. I love that. And I love the word, Cordell, that you used, available. And I think we're in those situations. We have to make our souls, our self, available. I had to be available to this young man. Even though in the first time I massaged somebody with AIDS, I kept running to the bathroom, quite frankly. But I eventually learned all the safety routines. And so I didn't have to be nervous. But yes, I had to be available. And it, whatever it was, the lesson was available to me. I love that word that you used. Okay, now we have a couple more people. I'm going to go around clockwise.
One of the disturbing things about the dream work is that one can't help but notice that your waking life has the same characteristics as your dreaming life. A recurring theme of my dreams is that I'm the only one to do something. And you might have noticed that I'm only the only one sitting in the front row here.
Well, thank you for being in the front row. And there's something you said I wanted to go back to. The Oh, well, maybe they'll come back to me. Tell me what you said at the beginning again.
It's a recurring dream that I have that I'm all alone, the only one to do something. And today, I'm the only one sitting in the front row.
Okay, the phrase I think I heard you say earlier was looking at dreams and looking at waking life. And whenever the dream looks exactly like our waking life, then you might say, well, why is this dream coming to me? It looks the same. And that's exactly what happened. Well, one piece of that, this is the one I'm going to give now, is it's an invitation to see our waking life as having all the spiritual opportunities that it does have.
Jim, what was that name you gave when somebody is a model for soul work? You said
exemplar causality. Now, it's used in philosophy that way, but it's used a few other ways. That's the way I first learned it. If I see someone that has taken their life in hand in an area I would like to, I am motivated by that.
So I needed that word. So exemplar causality. When my mother died, my brothers and I were holding her at home. And she was a very strong woman and very clear about values. And so as we were holding her, she took her last breath. Of course, we were sobbing and crying. And about a minute later, she took in a breath. And she came back. And, of course, we were like, yeah. And she opened her eyes and she said to us, this is good practice for you children. Always the teacher and the mother. She says, because you will be around dying people. You will be dying. And then she closed her eyes, and then she went back. And so I always had this vision of my mother, this strong black woman, sitting in the boat in the River Styx. You know, the guy is moving her across. And halfway across, she taps him on the shoulder and says, excuse me, sir, I have to go back and say something to my children. And the guy says, I'm sorry, but God is waiting for you. And my mother says, did you hear what I said? And so the River Styx guy looks at God, and God said, did you hear what she said? And so she came back, and she talked to us. So why am I telling you that? Is that after that, my youngest brother, his mother-in-law died of breast cancer at 68. Very terrible death, the death mask. It was a horrible death. And his wife could not stay in the room as she was crossing over. And my brother and I sat there with Charlotte as she was dying, and we looked at each other. And he's 15 years my junior. And we said, Mother was right. We can be with the dying now. And from that moment, I've never been afraid to be with my own dying, to be with my friends, to talk about it. And that's the soul work that just was given to me by my mother.
Wow. What a blessing.
In brief, I can't believe I'm in a room with so many people who do dream work and haven't mentioned that, of course, soul and soul and soul. And there are at least three that we can think of right off, an accident and accidental. But, so, there you go. Soul, soul.
All right. Okay, we're going to wrap up here. And my hope for today has been that through stories and examples that I might have conveyed to you a little bit about the concept of soul work in my life and how it has come to me, not by my planning it. And so I want to perhaps ease the burden, if there is one on anybody, that you're going to have to sit down and plan your soul work. No, you just have your eyes and ears and heart open and be available to what becomes available to you. And that is my wish and my hope and my blessing for you today. Thank you.